Hello, and welcome to the commentary for lesson 303. This is Proverbs 24. And I dug a little deep on some of these because there was a lot of good stuff in here. Verse 5, it says, "The wise are mightier than the strong, and those with knowledge grow stronger and stronger. So don't go to war without wise advice. Victory depends on having many advisors." We've seen that before. That's sort of one of the consistent themes that Solomon tries to make that point very clear, that especially a king and a judge needs wise advisors. I love verse 10. It says, "If you fail under pressure, your strength is too small." Now, on the surface, that may seem like a discouraging scripture. However, I want to point you to the Bible talks there were tons of scripture I could have brought for this because it's all over the place in the Bible. But I just want to talk about maybe three scriptures specifically that talk about strength. Psalm 18:39 was written by King David. "You have armed me with strength for the battle. You have subdued my enemies under my feet." Now, we know that's true because when we read the story of David, he was a musician. He was a shepherd boy. He was a lover, not a fighter. And he never wanted to kill anyone without express instructions from God. He wouldn't even kill Saul, his mortal enemy. So I love that we see that throughout David's life, and he knows that his strength comes from the Lord. I also want to point you to Apostle Paul, who wrote in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. I'm going to read from verse 9 and 10. "And he has said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distress, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong.'" Now, in reference to that scripture, Paul was talking about a thorn in his flesh. He referred to it in verse 7. He says, "Because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, for this reason, to keep me from exalting myself, there was given me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me, to keep me from exalting myself. Concerning this, I implore the Lord three times. The Lord three times that it might leave me." So Paul has a thorn in his flesh, and we don't know really what that is. Scholars have a lot of ideas about what it could be, but there is no real answer given in Scripture. So you can just sort of hypothesize about it, but it's so bad that it bothered Paul consistently, and he asked three times that God would take it from him. Now, I went to gotquestions.org because I wondered if they knew or had an idea of what the thorn in Paul's flesh was. And like I said before, they suggested that many explanations have been put forward, but that nobody really knows. It could have been referring to a physical, spiritual, or emotional affliction, or something entirely different, but has never been answered with satisfaction. Since he was not talking of a literal thorn, he must have been speaking metaphorically. Some of the more popular theories include temptation, a chronic eye problem, malaria, migraines, epilepsy, a speech disability. Some even say it could have that the thorn may have referred to a person, such as Alexander the coppersmith, who apparently did Paul a great deal of harm, and that was explained in 2 Timothy chapter 4. So we don't know exactly what this thorn is, but we do know it was a real source of pain in his life. And like I did before, when you back up a little bit to verse 7, Paul gives us a clue concerning the thorn's purpose, and it was really to keep him from becoming conceited. Why would he be conceited? Well, he had greatness of revelations. So he had a close relationship with God. He was able to speak truth. He was probably revelations. I think that might be insight that God gives him. I don't know if it was prophecy. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know if Paul had that gift. My assumption is no, but that clues that maybe he at least had wisdom and a close relationship with God. We do know that. And he could have gotten full of himself, and he could have gotten prideful. So he calls the messenger of Satan, he calls it a messenger of Satan to torment me, to keep me from exalting myself. So just as God allowed Satan to torment Job, remember that, in Job chapter 1, God also allowed Satan to torment Paul. And it was just for God's own purposes to keep him humble. So I'm going to read a little bit from, continue reading a little bit from Got Questions, because this is good. No one likes to live in pain. Paul sought the Lord 3 times to remove the source of pain. He probably had many good reasons why he should be pain-free. He could make the point to God that, you know, he could be more effective in ministry. He could reach out to more people with the gospel. He could glorify God even more. I'm sure he gave lots of reasons to God as he was praying for healing or relief. But the Lord was more concerned with building Paul's character and preventing pride. So that can kind of tell us how important it is to God, even more important than our works, is our heart and our character. Instead of removing the problem, whatever it was, God gave Paul more overwhelming grace and more compensating strength. Paul learned that God's power is made perfect in weakness. That was in verse 9. I learned that throughout my breast cancer struggle, that I was as weak as I've ever been in my life. I hated being weak. I hated needing my husband to get something out of the cupboard for me. For a time, if I was going to the restroom, he even had to pull up my underwear, which was humiliating. I hated needing him like that. But you know, certainly God's power is made perfect in weakness, because people look at us when we should be falling apart and we're not. And a good scripture about that comes in, where was it? Verse 16, the godly may trip 7 times, but they will get up again. But one disaster is enough to overflow the wicked. God was my source of strength. And like I said, when others look at us and think we should be falling apart and we're not, most of them want to know why. We are a walking testimony. Our stories, the trials that we go through, are for a purpose. We should be so excited about God's care for us that we can't help but share it. Okay. And then one more scripture I wanted to touch on, and that's Philippians 4:13. For I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Okay. That's good stuff. So then we go to verse 11. It said, rescue those who are unjustly sentenced to die. Save them as they stagger to their death. Now notice that specifies unjustly sentenced to die. So I went to Got Questions and I wondered, what does the Bible say about the death penalty? I think we've probably talked about this before, but I just wanted to reiterate it a little bit. The answer given here says the Old Testament law commanded the death penalty for various acts in the Old Testament, like Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy. It came up several times. These acts were murder, kidnapping, bestiality, adultery, homosexuality, being a false prophet, prostitution, and rape, and among other crimes, several other crimes. So, however, God often showed mercy when the death penalty was due. David, King David, committed adultery and murder, yet God did not demand his life be taken. Ultimately, every sin we commit should result in the death penalty, because the wages of sin is death. Thankfully, God demonstrates his love for us in not condemning us. Romans 5:8. So, how should we view the death penalty? First, we need to remember that God instituted capital punishment in his word. So, it would be presumptuous of us to think that we could institute a higher standard. God has the highest standard of any being because he's perfect. He is holy. And second, we must recognize that God has given government the authority to determine when capital punishment is due. You can find that in Genesis 9:6 and Romans 13:1-7. So it is unbiblical to claim that God opposes the death penalty in all circumstances. So we should never rejoice, obviously, when the death penalty is employed, but at the same time, we should not fight against the government's right to execute the perpetrators of the most evil of crimes. If you are curious about the death penalty and want to know more, there is a recommended resource given. It's a book called The Death Penalty on Trial, Taking a Life for a Life, by Ron Gleason. Okay, so, that just came from specifying unjustly sentenced to die. That's what that scripture refers to. Okay. Verse 13, my child, eat honey, for it is good, and the honeycomb is sweet to the taste. In the same way, this is verse 14, wisdom is sweet to your soul. If you find it, you will have a bright future, and your hopes will not be cut short. So, I like that. Verse 14 makes it clear that verse 13 is a metaphor to make a point about wisdom. The honey is a metaphor about wisdom. But you know what's cool is that now we know a lot more about honey. Maybe they knew it then, but they didn't really write down what it did. But especially local raw honey, it's more than just a natural sweetener. It's good for your hair, your skin, it helps with inflammation, and it builds your immunities. That's the biggie. But it has many other benefits too. I perused that in Pinterest, and I found, so if you're on Pinterest, if you have an account and you love to search Pinterest for things, health benefits of honey. So many, many more. I mean, there was hundreds of health benefits and for personal use benefits. But so sometimes it's cool, you know, because I think, you know, scripture gives these examples of things that are good. And yes, it was a metaphor, but you know, I wonder sometimes if they were also saying it because, you know, God knew the health benefits of honey. And so he encouraged, through this proverb, Solomon encourages people to eat honey. Okay, verse 16. I read that already, but this is one that I really liked. The godly may trip 7 times, but they will get up again. But one disaster is enough to overthrow the wicked. Love that. So don't rejoice when your enemies fall. Don't be happy when they stumble, for the Lord will be displeased with you and will turn his anger away from them. Well, we don't want that. Okay. Don't testify against your neighbors without cause. Don't lie about them. That's nothing new. We've seen that before. One thing I did like was verse 30 through the end of this Proverbs. I'll just read this. I walked by the field of a lazy person, the vineyard of one with no common sense. I saw that it was overgrown with nettles. It was covered with weeds, and its walls were broken down. Then, as I looked and thought about it, I learned this lesson. A little extra sleep, a little more slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, then poverty will pounce on you like a bandit. Scarcity will attack you like an armed robber. So, you know, I talk about how much I love sleep. Well, I decided to start a new habit, and so for the next 30 days, I have a goal, and that is to go to bed earlier and get up earlier. So, this is something I really struggle with. And I'm not sure exactly why, but I'm going to figure it out because I think there's a lot of other areas in my life that would be better if I was able to get up earlier. Now, I already do get up early because I have to drive the boys to school. They have to be there at 7:45 and it's like a half hour drive. So I do get up early, but I know that I would do better to get up before my boys and be able to collect myself, right? So I decided I would go to bed at 9:30 and I would wake up at 5:30 and see if that doesn't make some positive changes in my life. So far, I've gone 2 days of going to bed at 9:30. I can't say that it's helped me get up early feeling refreshed. It's safe to say that I am not a morning person, but I'm able to push through that and I'm able to just, I'm purposely scheduling things, appointments and things right after I drop the boys off at school so that I don't get tempted to try to take a nap or something later. So I keep myself occupied. I push through that morning time, which is so difficult for me. But the point that I think is made here by Solomon especially is that we should be observant and learn from the mistakes of others. I like that he says, you know, he walked by the field of a lazy person. And he noticed it was overgrown with nettles, it was covered with weeds, and the walls were broken down. This is key, verse 32. Then, as I looked and thought about it, I learned this lesson. And that's when he goes into sleep and how it can devastate you if you're lazy and all you want to do is sleep. So definitely that's a lesson about observing the world around us, observing. You know, a good example is I observe what old people do around here because they know, I don't know a lot about what plants grow well here or what time of year to do certain tasks in the yard or in the garden. And so I watch old people because they're smart. They know stuff. So when I see that all old people seem to have tons of azaleas, they love azaleas, and they don't have a lot of flower beds up next to their house. They like keep their yards really simple. So I thought, you know, that's partly because they're physically unable to do much yard work, but I should strive to do that, to simplify my yard so that when I'm older, I can manage it. And so I watch them. I take note. In the same way, we should watch when others slip and fall and make stupid mistakes because we see how it always plays out over and over again. Notice the patterns, right? So really, that's it. There was a lot of good stuff in there, but that's it for Proverbs for now. And we'll get into some Song of Songs. And that'll be good stuff too. So that's it for today. I hope you all have a great day. I will talk to you soon.